The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week I talked about tools and practices to support concentration, to support the mind settling down on the breathing in particular. We talked about mindfulness of breathing and how that supports concentration and ways to incline the mind towards settling down. Kind of some of my favorite tools and techniques for doing that. And this week I'd like to continue talking about that, but from kind of a different perspective. I'd like to talk about the concentration in terms of what gets in its way, what factors of mind kind of obscure or obstruct and get in the way of getting concentrated. There's a list that the Buddha offered that are five basic qualities or factors of mind that tend to obstruct or hinder concentration, and given that that's what their function is partly in the mind, the Buddha gave this list the name the hindrances. Or he didn't give it the name the hindrances, he gave it the name the nivaranas, or whatever language he spoke in, but we translate it as the hindrances. Another translation of that term, though, I mean, hindrances is a pretty good word for it, because with respect to trying to settle the mind down, these factors get in the way. But we can tend to relate to that term hindrance with a kind of an aversive attitude. You know, that when we think of these things as hindrances, we think, well, you know, they're bad, they're wrong, I'm not supposed to have them. And it can create a kind of a combative relationship with them. So there's another translation for this term, nivarana, and it means covering. So the hindrances kind of cover up, or it's kind of like clouds cover up the sun, but they don't do anything to the sun, right? I mean, they're just covering the sun. And likewise, these hindrances don't do anything to the mind and the capacity of the mind to become concentrated. They just cover it up. And so the point is to begin to get familiar with them, to acknowledge them, to recognize them, to begin to work with them, and not to just have this attitude of I need to cut them out or get rid of them. So I'd like to talk about these five qualities tonight, how they obstruct concentration and how we can work with them in our practice. And while I'll be focusing tonight from the perspective of primarily the concentration practice, I think you'll recognize as I talk about these how what I'm saying about the hindrances kind of applies not only to concentration practice, but also to just our general meditation practice and even to our daily lives, to working with states like these that come up all the time. Because these are factors that hinder concentration, but they also often come up just in our lives. So these five factors are sense desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, which counts as one, restlessness, and doubt. So I'd like to talk a little bit about what each of these hindrances is, you know, what it means, what each one means, and how it gets in the way of this concentration practice that we've been talking about in the last week. So sense desire. Sense desire is this movement of mind to surround ourselves by pleasant things, to feel like we need to have pleasant sense experience in our lives in order to be happy. The desire to create this situation where we have all these pleasant sense experiences is sense desire. So sense desire, the pleasurable things themselves, the fact of the existence of pleasurable things in our environment isn't a problem. That's not what this sense desire is about. It's kind of about the mind's need to arrange the world to create a comfortable, happy, pleasant environment, and that the mind can't feel satisfied until it does that. And so, you know, we tend to get onto a kind of an endless loop with this kind of process, because since things are impermanent, things don't stay the way they are very long. And so however we arrange the world, it breaks down after some period of time. And then we have to do it again and again and again. And so we end up on this cycle of trying to do this. And so it keeps the mind pretty busy and keeps the mind kind of agitated to keep trying to figure out, how can I keep arranging the world this way? And so what this movement of mind is kind of moving out to the multiplicity of things in the world. It's not settling here inside on one thing. So the concentration practice is the main tool for that concentration practice is to settle the attention on one experience, the experience of breathing. And we tend to, if we've got sense desire in our mind, we tend to be, you know, thinking about, well, how can I have a good meal this afternoon, or, you know, what can I do to make my house more comfortable, or how can I make sure that my work environment feels good to me? So our minds go out trying to fix the environment, and it doesn't stay in touch with the experience of breathing. So that movement to sense desire kind of really directly obstructs our ability to stay present in the present moment. Now, last week, in talking about the concentration practice and in the guided meditation as well, I was encouraging you to recognize whether there was comfortable experience in the body. And in a way, this is using that natural movement of sense desire, channeling it in a skillful direction, so that when we can find a way that the breathing feels good, feels pleasurable, feels comfortable, that desire of the mind to scatter out and try to fix the world out there kind of can settle down into the pleasantness of the breathing itself. So it's kind of like we're turning that energy of sense desire to, you know, the creation of a world of sense pleasure, to the creation of a pleasurable mental and physical experience in here. And so that allows the mind to settle down a little bit. So that's sense desire. Then ill will is the movement of mind that, you know, doesn't like things, wants to get rid of things. When there's unpleasant experience, that movement to push things away, either out of that movement of anger or the movement of recoiling oneself out of fear. So there can be kind of different movements around anger, either the lashing out and attacking, or the pulling back and recoiling in fear. And so with those kinds of movements around experience, you know, that the mind, again, doesn't settle down on the breathing. You know, The texts say when the mind is pestered by ill will, then the mindfulness towards the object doesn't occur uninterruptedly. So, you know, there's like, you kind of have this image of a fly buzzing around your head, you know, how annoying that is. And the mind just keeps going out to that. How can I get rid of that so that the mind doesn't settle into the breathing? So the concentration develops by the continuity of the awareness on the breathing. And so when we're pestered by ill will, I like that word, pestered, you know, when that happens, you know, the mind just kind of keeps going out. So again, that quality of mind kind of gets in the way of the concentration. The third one, sloth and torpor, is kind of sleepiness and dullness of mind. It includes both sides of that, where the sleepiness can be physical, you know, a physical, actual sleepiness comes over us, Or there can be a kind of a dullness of mind, a kind of a stuporous quality in the mind, where it's just like it's not functioning very well. Often that comes with tiredness, but it can also just be a thickness or a heaviness of mind. And again, with that, either with sleepiness, you know, with sleepiness, if we're falling asleep, where it's interrupting the ability to stay present for the breathing. With that dullness of mind or that thickness of mind, it's hard for the mind to actually connect with the breath itself in order to be present for it. So again, it kind of gets in our way. It obstructs or obscures the ability to stay with the breathing. Then there's restlessness. And there's two sides to restlessness as well. The sleepiness has the physical sleepiness and the kind of dullness of mind. And the restlessness also has a restless quality of body, where the body just can feel really highly energetic. Or some of you may have experienced this in meditation, where it kind of feels like there's jumping beans under your skin. It's like you cannot sit still. It's like misery to try to sit still. That's restlessness. That's the energetic quality of bodily restlessness. Then there is the mental quality of restlessness, where the mind can't sit still. The mind is just kind of running all over the place, scattered, thinking about this and that. It may not be particularly trying to, you know, create a pleasant world or get rid of unpleasant things, but it may just be distracted and scattered. So that's that quality of restlessness. Now, I think often there is this quality of restlessness is paired with other of these hindrances, so that if there is that pestered quality of ill will, often there's a restless quality of mind trying to figure out how to get rid of that thing. So this quality of restlessness can often be paired with other hindrances. So this, again, the scatteredness of mind prevents us from connecting with our experience of breathing. And the physical restlessness, the quality where it feels like you just can't sit still, it's a pretty powerful, unpleasant physical sensation. And that can kind of just pull the attention, that powerful, energetic experience of body that feels like that jumping beans under your skin. So again, that pulls us away from the stability of staying with the breath. And then there's doubt. And doubt in this context means doubt in either the teachings of the Buddha or the tools and techniques that he taught for meditation, or doubt in our ability to engage with them. And so in doubt, often we're caught in thought, thinking about, well, how does this work anyway? Or, you know, what point is it to pay attention to the breath all, you know, over and over again? What does it have to do with anything? Or if we try and we see our mind wander, we sit there thinking, well, I can't do this. You know, everybody else seems to be able to do this, but, you know, clearly I can't do this. There's much better things I can do with my time than sit here watching my mind wander and come back and wander and come back. So with doubt, we tend to be lost in a world of thinking about the doubts. So again, we are not here, present for the breath in the present moment. So that's just kind of an overview of these five qualities of mind and how they tend to get in our way. Now, that makes it sound kind of bleak in a way, you know, if these qualities of mind arise, it's hopeless for us. But it's not. The power of mindfulness, of awareness, of recognizing these qualities kind of turns them from being hindrances into just being part of what our experience is. And so I'd like to talk about different ways to do this. And first I'm going to talk about how we can work with these when they're not terribly strong. And if we're trying to work with concentration, where we're trying to cultivate our mindfulness on the breathing and steady our minds on the breathing, when these hindrances come up, one of the ways to play with this or work with this is to kind of let them go, you know, set them aside, not give them much attention. And know that they're there. It's really helpful to acknowledge, oh yeah, there's restlessness that's coming up, or there's ill will. I see this sense of, I don't like that that way that breath feels, so that the way that we're attending to the breath kind of has this quality of, I don't like that breath, I want a better breath. So with that, seeing that ill will, one way to approach it is to simply just recognize, okay, yeah, ill will is present, and I'm just going to set it aside. Just going to acknowledge it, know it's there, but just come back to the breath. So kind of what this is, kind of, it's kind of leaving the hindrance in the background. It's letting it be and not giving it any attention. So this needs to be done with care. You know, it's a helpful approach if you can do it skillfully. It really takes a recognition of whether that movement to ignore or leave it in the background includes any quality of suppression or, you know, aversion, a pushing away. If that is how you're engaging with that ignoring and leaving in the background, if you're doing that kind of pushing away, then you're actually cultivating the quality of ill will. So, you know, that's kind of cultivating that hindrance, that other hindrance of ill will. So there's a kind of a very fine balance for us, and it takes some skill, it takes some practice to learn how to just let something be, you know, just let it be there in the background. And I kind of learned how to do this when I started doing concentration practice, when I started, you know, playing with just being with one object over and over again. In my first concentration retreat was a metta retreat, so I was doing the metta phrases over and over again as my concentration object. And I have a very strong pattern of anger and ill will, and so that was coming up a lot. But it was kind of a relief at one point when I realized, oh, I don't have to actually do anything with that. All I, you know, I can just, you know, it can just be there. I can just keep doing the metta phrases. It was just kind of nice to recognize that I didn't have to engage with that energy, that I could just keep going with what I was doing. Now, it can't be a complete ignoring. It can't be a, you know, pushing it aside. There needs to be a kind of a recognition. Yes, that hindrance is there, that ill will is there in that case, and I'm continuing to do the metta. It's kind of a foreground, background kind of thing. You know, recognizing that something is in the background, but leaving your attention on something else in the forehand, the breath or the metta phrases. So just, you know, recognize that hindrance is there, but don't give it any energy. So my understanding of how this works, you know, is that when the attention is directed elsewhere, so, you know, there's this hindrance, restlessness, or whatever in the back of the mind, and we're paying attention to the breath, not giving any attention to that hindrance. It's just kind of doing its thing. When we do that, essentially what happens is the hindrance is not, it doesn't have anything to feed on. The hindrances tend to feed on, first of all, they feed on unawareness. So when you're mindful and aware that it's there, you've got some protection just right off the bat. And then, you know, the hindrances also tend to feed on, you know, kind of a looping thinking pattern, you know, that we tend to think about what that hindrance is pulling us to. And so if we can stay with the breath, and we're tending to cut into that pattern around the thinking loop around that hindrance. So that's kind of the nourishment for the hindrance, is the way we think and feed it. We feed it with our thoughts. And so without that nourishment, the hindrance tends to settle down over time. So again, in this practice, it needs to be really skillful use of this ignoring, or we have to be really honest with ourselves about whether we can do that skillfully, to look in our minds and see if there's any wanting or aversion around that setting aside of that hindrance. Another way, if the hindrance is a little bit stronger, I know that first way that I'm talking about, at least for me, tends to work when the hindrance is not very strong, you know, when it's just a little niggling thing. It's like, yeah, okay, I see you, and, you know, you can do your thing, and I'm just going to pay attention to the breath. You know, I sometimes have had a conversation, almost a little conversation in my mind like that with the quality. It's like, yeah, I see you, and I see, you know, that, You know, you need to do your thing, but, you know, you can do your thing, but I'm just going to put my attention over here, you know. So for me, that kind of all got collapsed into the phrase, not now, you know, just not now. With that kind of lightness, you know, it's not a, not now, not now. It's a, no, not now. I'm going to be with the breath right now. So as if these hindrances are a little stronger, and they're, you know, we can't like have the sense of having them in the background. That's one way to look at that first one, is if we can really stay with the breath in the foreground and leave the hindrances in the background. That's fine. You know, you don't need to actively address the hindrances if they can just stay in the background. But if they're stronger and there's not a sense of being able to leave it in the background, then one thing you can do is to kind of breathe with the hindrance. So, you know, that's the case we're doing mindfulness of breathing. You know, there's the hindrance of desire coming up, and we can just breathe with the desire. You know, there may be a way in which that desire feels like it's in the body. It may feel like there's a pull towards something. You know, I really want to open my eyes right now. You know, I just can't stand to sit here with my eyes closed anymore. And so there's this kind of energy towards pulling to open the eyes. If you can breathe with that feeling of pulling, you know, just breathe, you know, every breath, just kind of let every breath massage that feeling of pulling. Or perhaps there's a, you know, an aversion to a pain in your body. You know, not a strong pain, but, you know, one that you know, just kind of keeps pulling your attention over and over again. You know, a pain in the knee or something. You know, you could just have a sense of breathing through that part of your body so that you're not ignoring the thing that's creating the agitation in the mind, but you're also staying connected with the breathing. It's kind of like observing that place or that thing with the breathing. So that's another way to work with these hindrances. And then if they're even stronger and there's just a sense that, you know, there's no way I can stay with the breath here, no way I can leave it in the background, no way I can even think about breathing with the hindrance, then it's time to start looking at these hindrances more directly, to working with them more directly. And there's kind of two basic paths for this. There is a path where, or maybe techniques, we could say, two different kind of techniques for working with the hindrances more directly. And one is the technique of kind of recognizing that the hindrance is there and applying what we could call an antidote to the hindrance. So, for instance, the classic antidote for ill will, if you're noticing strong ill will in your mind, is to kind of change your meditation to a metta practice. So that the metta practice is kind of a classic antidote for ill will. Now, this may work for some and not for others. This did not work for me for quite a while. I mean, you know, when I was experiencing ill will, to try to bring metta to the the thing that I was feeling ill will for just felt like it was going, you know, counter to what was happening in my mind. And I just really couldn't do that. Other people do have a kind of an easy connection with metta. And it's a very natural way to help counter ill will in your mind. So just look in your own experience and see if this is helpful for you. Is it helpful if you're thinking about, you know, if what's happening for you is you keep going back to an argument that you were having with a friend this afternoon? One way to approach that, and that argument is generating ill will and anger and frustration in the moment, then one way to approach that would be to turn towards metta, towards kindness, towards your friend. You know, consciously recall and think about ways that that friend is supportive for you. Wish them well, wish them happiness. Consciously turn the attention in that direction. So that's a way to work with ill will, that kind of antidote way. With sense desire, the standard antidote for sense desire is to reflect on, to bring up a contemplation of impermanence about the thing that you're wanting. You know, so, you know, say you're having a fantasy about a new relationship. You know, this person's coming up in your mind a lot. You know, one way to, this may sound a little funny, but, you know, one way to think about this or to do this is to recall that that person is impermanent, that they will age, they will grow old, they will get sick, and they will die. So, that, I mean, it's not to say that you're wishing that for them, or, you know, that you're, you know, wanting to have an aversive attitude towards them. But it's kind of like what it begins to do is it points to the reality around, you know, with sense desire, part of what fuels the sense desire is this this illusion that if we get this thing, then we'll be happy forever. And you know, we know intellectually we won't be, but the sense desire just has this delusion kind of built into it, that in the movement to satisfy that sense desire, there's this deluded belief that, yeah, that thing's going to make me happy. It's really going to do it for me. So if you can just reflect on the fact that that thing is impermanent, it is going to go away. I mean, it might even be, you know, something as simple as a piece of chocolate, you know. How long does that happiness last? You know, just reflect on the impermanence of the satisfaction that one would receive from some kind of sense pleasure. It begins to help us to have a more balanced relationship around sense pleasure, not one that's fueled with this deluded idea that, yeah, this piece of chocolate, this is going to do it for me. I mean, that sounds silly, but, you know, looking at it in the moment of wanting that chocolate, that's what the mind believes. So, you know, just trying to create a little balance in the mind around this this powerful tendency of sense desire. With sloth and torpor, we can try to generate some energy, find ways to counter the heaviness or dullness of mind by taking some action to bring some energy into the system. Opening the eyes, looking at light, going for a walk, those are all things that can support energy coming into the system. Taking deeper breaths will support a little more energy. So again, these are ways to kind of counter the hindrances with some antidotes. The antidotes for the other two, restlessness and doubt, are much closer to mindfulness practice. And so I'm going to now talk about the other way to work with these hindrances when they're stronger, and that is to meet them with mindfulness. to let go of trying to stay with the breath and turn your attention directly to the experience of the hindrance. And this makes perfect sense because, you know, the hindrance is kind of what's up in the mind. And so we can continue to cultivate our mindfulness and cultivate the concentration that comes with the continuity of mindfulness by turning our mindful attention to the hindrance itself. Now, in concentration practice, you know, we're trying to steady our minds on one thing. And so, in a sense, this turning towards the hindrance directly is leaving that kind of concentration that's stabilizing the mind on one thing. But it moves us into the cultivation of mindfulness on changing experience, on our moment-to-moment experience. I didn't talk about this so much last week, so I'll take a minute to just talk about it now. That, you know, basically concentration comes because we stabilize our attention in the present moment. The easiest way tends to be to pick one thing to pay attention to. That picking one thing to pay attention to, the breath, the mind can pretty easily recognize when it's paying attention to the breath and when it's not. And so it stabilizes the attention in the present moment relatively easily, at least for some people, relatively easily. Relatively easily. to have a single object. And yet, it's also possible, and actually some minds are naturally more inclined this way, to stabilize the attention on just changing experience, on just whatever is happening in the present moment. So, you know, we can stabilize our attention on hearing or, you know, a flow between bodily sensation and hearing and emotions. Just the recognition of the kind of flow of life. The awareness can stabilize on that, and a kind of concentration develops out of that stabilization of awareness. So the awareness gets stabilized, the experiences kind of feel like they're changing. And that's a difference in the way that types of concentration feel. You know, in the concentration on the breath, the mind settles down and the thing we're paying attention to gets still too. So the mind moves into a great place of quiet and stillness. With this other way, the mind gets very still, but what we're experiencing may be quite quite a, you know, show. Maybe just, you know, quite a changing flow of experience. So the turning the attention to the hindrances directly, it allows us to cultivate that kind of concentration, the kind of concentration where the awareness gets stable. But things are changing. And so we can pay attention to the changing nature of the mind and the body with respect to this hindrance. So turning to the hindrances, and I'll just talk about these briefly, I hope, because I want to leave some time to have discussion. With sense desire and ill will, these two, with respect to turning mindfulness towards them, there's kind of some similarities there. Both sense desire and ill will have this kind of movement out into the world to arrange the world to satisfy us, either to get rid of things we don't like or to have things that we do like. And so our orientation with sense desire and ill will tends to be outward. We're focused on the thing out there that we want or the thing out there that we want to get rid of. So the movement in mindfulness around these hindrances is to turn the attention inward, let go of the thing in the world that we think we want or want to get rid of, and turn to the state that of the feeling of the desire or the ill will itself. Turn the attention inward. What does it feel like? What does it feel like to have this state? Particularly helpful to turn the attention to the body, because often there's, as I said earlier, there's often a lot of thoughts around our hindrances, and so you know, with the hindrance of sense desire, there's all kinds of thoughts about how can I get that thing, you know, how can I arrange things so that I can have that and make sure that I keep it, and if I have it, how can I, you know, make sure nobody takes it away from me. So there's all kinds of thoughts that are kind of spiraling, both around wanting to have things and wanting to get rid of things. And so if we can turn our attention into the bodily state of sense desire or ill will, one of the big benefits of that is that it takes our attention out of our thoughts. And so that, again, we lose that, the hindrance loses its nourishment. It loses the feeding quality that the thoughts give it. And when the hindrance loses the nourishment, you know, there can be some momentum to it. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the hindrance is kind of like a car going down the freeway at, you know, 100 miles an hour, that there's this, you know, this momentum towards doing and fixing and changing and getting and having and holding on. And the mind is just going at 100 miles an hour in that direction. And what the mindfulness does is it puts that energy into neutral. Like, you know, if you're going 100 miles an hour down the freeway and you put the car into neutral, the car doesn't stop. The car keeps going. But it will stop because you're no longer fueling it. And so it's kind of similar. The mindfulness is like disengaging the gears of those hindrances so that they can kind of come to stop of their own accord. They have some kind of momentum behind them, but if there's no fuel, they'll just eventually wind out. So turning the attention towards the feeling, letting go of the thoughts as much as possible. And you'll find, you know, at least, you know, I find that the mind, you know, can pay attention to the body for a little while and then it loses track and it's back in the thoughts. It's like, okay, you know, just come back. Just keep coming back, keep coming back. It's kind of like that's what our object of meditation is, that feeling of the sense desire or ill will. And how it changes as we pay attention to it. Then with sloth and torpor, this is actually one of my favorite hindrances to explore with mindfulness. You know, I talked earlier about ways to counter the dullness and sleepiness with taking action, you know, by opening the eyes or standing up or taking a walk or breathing more deeply. Those are all very helpful things to do. And it also can be interesting and helpful to explore what does it mean to pay attention to sleepiness or dullness of mind. It's possible. It's actually possible. I mean, we think because we're sleepy that we can't meditate. You know, I'm too sleepy to meditate. If you have enough awareness to think that thought, I'm too sleepy to meditate, you probably have enough awareness to be able to pay attention to your sleepiness. So, you know, to pay attention to the sleepiness, one of the keys, at least, that I've found around this is to recognize first if there's any resistance to the sleepiness. So is there any ill will? Is there any aversion to the sleepiness? Typically, if we're trying to meditate, often there is a resistance to the sleepiness. And one of the funny things about this bodily experience of sleepiness is if we're resisting it, it feels really unpleasant. If we're not resisting it, it feels really pleasant. You all actually know this, you know, if you, you know, lie down to sleep at night, you know, the body and mind actually naturally moves into that pleasantness of sleep. And so we can kind of use this, at least I've used it and had pretty good success with it, to you know, just turn to the experience of the body and the mind that feels sleepy. Let's see if you can let go of resistance. Notice the pleasantness or unpleasantness. If it's really just sleepiness, probably any unpleasantness is a result from resistance to it. So if you can let go of the resistance and just feel how it feels to have the body feel sleepy. I've actually, you know, watched the sleepiness descend. You know, just watch, and it feels, ooh, it feels really good, you know. And with that pleasantness, with the mind actually being able to connect with and attend to that pleasantness of sleepiness, the pleasantness can be a little bit of a enlivening factor for the mind. It can be a little bit of interest for the mind to, oh yeah, this is how it feels to be sleepy. So the mind can get interested in the sleepiness, and that can help to keep the mind a little bit alert, alert enough to pay attention to the sleepiness. We don't have to get rid of the sleepiness. We can just pay attention to it. And I've had some sittings where pretty much the whole sitting, I just watched sleepiness. You know, there would be times where one particular one I remember, I watched it descend and just felt the kind of warm and relaxed feelings in the body. You know, it kind of felt like the sleepiness descended through the body. The body got all soft. And then the mind started going into these, like, rhythm waves. And then I would drop. And then I would, okay, and then I would just do it all over again. And I got in that sitting, you know, about 45 minutes sitting, it got to the place where I would know right before I was going to drop. You know, that the mind got so attuned to that place where it was going to, that it knew that it was going to do that. And what I could do in that moment was just straighten up the spine a little bit and then do it all over again. So it wasn't like I was struggling with the sleepiness, and it wasn't like it took a lot of energy to do this. It was just, you know, the energy that I engaged with was just being with what was happening and adding a little bit of straightening to the spine right before I was going to drop. So I really encourage this practice. It's really fun, actually, you know. It feels really good. Then there's dullness of mind, which has got a slightly different quality. You know, it just feels like this mud that you're trying to slog through. It's like you can't figure out how to pay attention to anything. And again, we can just notice that dullness of mind. So, you know, imagine if you were looking out of a window and there was fog. You know, we live in the Bay Area, so we're familiar with fog. You know, on a foggy day, looking out of the window, if you're trying to see things in the distance and see them clearly, you know, it's not going to work. But you can look out the window and know that it's foggy. You know that your eye is working perfectly well. You know, it's just that there's fog out there. Likewise, with this dullness of mind, we can just know dullness is happening. You know, we don't have to. What I think most of the time, the frustration around dullness is that we're trying to see something clearly with the mind in this state. So I find the noting helpful here, just using, oh, dullness is happening. Dullness is happening. And the mind can be aware of dullness, and that awareness can be very clear. Very clearly know dullness, just as clearly as the eye can see fog. Then restlessness. So physical and mental restlessness. I think the most helpful tool that I found, both for physical and mental restlessness, is to not have a sense of trying to contain the restlessness in the body, but kind of there's a sense that I have when I get that restless feeling either in the body or the mind. It's kind of like just let it get it as big as it wants to. It's kind of like the restless is all this energy particles, you know, rolling around. And if we're trying to contain that in a small space, the energy feels pretty unpleasant. But if you just have the kind of sense of an expansive quality, you know, let that restless feeling get as big as the room. Somehow, for me at least, that really brings a sense of, oh, okay, you know, It really just allows the energy to feel more dispersed, so it's not quite so tight in the body. When mental restlessness can have a sense of a lot of thinking. And often when there's that kind of restlessness, that kind of mental restlessness that has to do with a lot of thinking, there's some kind of emotion that's going on. And when, you know, that's the cause of that restlessness, if we can turn and check in and say, wow, you know, the mind is really kind of spinning here. What is happening? Just kind of, again, for me, it's kind of a sense of take a broader view, open up. What is happening here that the mind is spinning like this? And sometimes an emotion will be right there. There was one time I saw the mind was just spinning in this planning. It was just, you know, and I would come back. It's like, then it would go out again, and I'd come back. And finally it's like, wow, this is really strong. I wonder what's happening here. What else is going on here? And what I found was that I was really happy. Happiness had been fueling this kind of planning fit. And, you know, I was surprised by that. I would not have thought that happiness was underneath this planning fit, because the planning fit was not terribly pleasant. So, you know, I had actually been missing out on the happiness, because, you know, the happiness had kind of spurred this, well, how can I stay happy? What is it that I need to do to stay happy? And it's like, oh, I got to make sure this happens and this happens and this happens. And I missed the happiness. So opening up to, you know, is there an emotion underneath? And if you can open to that emotion, often the meeting of that emotion will stop fueling those thoughts, stop fueling that restless mind. Then there's doubt. I think the most important thing with doubt is to learn to recognize it, because it is so much in our mind. It is so much thoughts. And those thoughts, you know, thoughts, doubt about the teachings, doubt about the teachers, doubt about your the practice that you're doing, doubt about your capacity to do the practice that you're doing. Often this can sound like these very wise thoughts in your mind, like, oh, I really should, you know, be doing another practice right now. Or, you know, it can sound like this rational, you know, what the Buddha taught, you know, I'm sure it worked in his day, but, you know, he didn't have to deal with 18 different electronic devices. So I'm sure that, you know, it's not really that applicable to our time right now. So, you know, this is doubt. It sounds quite reasonable. You know, sometimes the doubt comes in this voice of masquerading as reason or even wisdom. So the main thing about doubt is to learn to recognize it, to learn that you've lost touch with the present moment because you're thinking about the practice, the teachings, the teacher, your capacity. I find that actually is one of the keys. If I find myself thinking about the teachings or what I'm doing, or should I be doing metta practice right now? Or should I maybe you know, do open awareness practice, or no, concentration. That's what I, concentration. No, metta. That kind of wavering is also doubt. So if you find yourself thinking about the practice, how you should engage with the practice, what the practice means, how it works, it's probably doubt in some form or other. So recognizing those kinds of thoughts is probably the biggest tool around doubt. Just begin to recognize it. And then again, you know, doubt can be fueled by emotions. It can be fueled by fear, or it can be fueled by insecurity, a sense of longing, of wanting. So again, if you can recognize that doubt is happening, then you can kind of open up and say, okay, and is there something else going on here? Grief or fear or frustration. You know, frustration can be a great source of doubt if we've been, you know, sitting here trying to pay attention to our breath and seeing our mind wander over and over again. You know, frustration arises, and if that frustration is not noticed, it can easily lead to, well, obviously I can't do this practice. You know, I shouldn't even try to do this practice. So noticing the frustration, If you can just be with, oh, frustration's happening, and work with it in the way that I've been describing around working with the hindrances, then the doubt is no longer an issue. It's just, oh, here's frustration. Can I let it be in the background, or maybe I can breathe with frustration, or maybe I need to actually look at it more carefully. So we can, because these hindrances do kind of get in the way in a sense of our concentration practice, we can have a sense that they're a problem. But, with this, the tools of mindfulness towards the hindrances, we're not actually losing anything we're losing a little bit of the concentration on a single stable object, but the concentration on the awareness is stabilizing on the experience of the hindrance itself. So as we work with these hindrances, when we can be mindful of a hindrance, it no longer functions as a hindrance. It's no longer blocking our path. We're actually cultivating mindfulness in connection with that quality. So the hindrances actually become our path. They're like the compost heap. It nurtures the soil to be with these difficult states. It nurtures the soil of mindfulness. It nurtures the opening of the heart to be with these difficult states. We learn about our minds. We learn about how our minds get all balled up and create their own suffering. It's very, very, very direct path through the suffering of the hindrances to freedom from suffering. And we don't actually have to get rid of the hindrances in order to have insight. Hindrances have that quality of struggle to them. And the first noble truth is understanding that struggle. So we can have insight in the midst of paying attention to hindrances. I've had some of my deepest recognitions in the midst of paying attention to self-hatred or anger or loneliness. Just how the mind is doing this to itself. So freedom can result from this practice of, not only the concentration helps to stabilize the mind, but the attention to the hindrances can also help stabilize the mind. So there's no time for questions, I'm sorry. Maybe we can have some questions next week. I'll make sure I leave time for questions next week. So thank you all for your attention.